Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water, otherwise known as EW, to order. And we're glad you're here today. We appreciate it. We appreciate that Representative Witt joined us just on time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome.
It's an honor.
And we have a couple of changes to the agenda, as usual. So if you're here for Senate Bill 518, we will not be hearing that bill today. If you're here for Senate Bill 626, we'll be carrying over Senate Bill 626 to our next meeting. So with that, I do want to open an informational hearing. It says meeting. Is it an informational meeting? Informational meeting?
Hearing.
Either way, we're having a meeting on a hearing, and it's just informational on fish screens. So with that, I'll open that informational thing. And ordinarily, I would say a few words about the subject for which we've all come together. But my vice chair, one of my members down at the end there, Representative Thompson, just wanted to say a few words about fish screens, and then we'll have our guests come up. Representative Thompson.
I think we'll pass on that.
All right, then. We'll depend on our experts. And we have three panels. And if we go a little long, I'll tell you. But right now, you have free rein. Just, you know, try to keep it concise. So first, would Kurt Melcher, Alan Ritchie, and Ray Hartlerode please come up?
As a member of the Health Care Committee, I have to point out that sometimes that our chair doesn't stay on his meds. And
I don't recall calling on you.
That creates a problem.
I just don't recall calling on you. Mr. Vice Chair.
Those are also known as Arcaricus Chowicha guides.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Okay, sorry, we're all a little silly. It's getting late in session. We apologize, but we're glad you're here.
Thanks. Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm Deputy Director with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to come here today and provide you an informational briefing on our fish screens program. I've brought with me our two agency experts in our fish screening program, Mr. Alan Ritchie, who's the current screens program manager, and Mr. Ray Hartlerode, who is a previous screens program manager. I think both have a number of years service with the department in this capacity. I did want to offer a few opening remarks, though, before I turn it over to them. Our screens program, we really actually have two programs within the department. We have a fish screening program and a fish passage program. We came today here prepared to give you an overview of our fish screen program. We'd be happy to also give you an overview of our fish passage program or do that individually if anyone wishes in the future. Both these programs are really great cooperative partnerships, if you will, working with both agricultural and other land managers in finding ways to improve conditions for fish in our state's rivers. We work closely on fish passage projects with the timber industry. I think you're going to have at least one member of a panel here in the future or following a subsequent panel is going to talk about fish passage as it relates to the timber industry and their work in improving conditions and fish passage conditions in their watersheds. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Alan Ritchie, and again, appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Okay. Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, as Kurt Melcher said, I'm Alan Ritchie with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm our Fish Screening and Passage Program Manager. Ray Hartlerode is here as well today, and he'll be following up later in the presentation. And we're going to give you an overview of our fish screening program. Oregon has been concerned about fish loss due to unscreened diversions for over 100 years. Fish screening laws began showing up in 1898, and fish screens have been required at various periods of time as the laws have changed over the last century. The Oregon Fish Screening Program began in 1947, and many hundreds of screens were built and maintained by the Oregon State Game Commission, the precursor for ODFW. Federal mitigation dollars from the construction of Columbia River dams were used to construct and maintain almost 500 screens in the John Day Basin alone. But by the mid-1970s, financial reductions resulted in the abandonment of most of these screen structures. In 1991, the Oregon legislature established a pilot cost-share program for the construction and maintenance of fish screens, and this program became permanent in 1995 and is still operating today to assist water users install and maintain fish screens for the protection of fish resources. So why install a fish screen? Fish screens are an important tool for the protection of fish in that they prevent the loss of fish at water diversions. In Oregon, we have many thousands of water diversions that serve agricultural, municipal, hydro, and other valuable uses of our water resources. Fish screens allow these diversions to divert water for its intended use while keeping the fish in the waterway where they belong. Without fish screens in place, fish are diverted down canals or removed from the stream system through pump intakes, and in most cases, fish diverted with the water will become mortalities. In addition to the fishery benefits, many water users appreciate fish screens due to their ability to remove debris. We've had many irrigators that use sprinklers comment on the reduced amount of clogging they experience in their sprinkler heads with the fish screens in place. So this picture is a little bit hard to understand what's going on here. This actually was taken this spring, so this is a real recent picture. I apologize for the quality of it. But what we're looking at here is this is an irrigation canal, and up here is actually a reflection from the fish screen and the features that go along with the fish screen. And you'll see a whole bunch of little fish in this canal. These are all juvenile Chinook salmon. This was taken in northeast Oregon a few weeks ago. So fortunately, in this case, all of these fish are on the upstream side of the fish screen. They're going to encounter this fish screen and be diverted back into the river that they came from. If not for this fish screen, all of these fish would be going down the ditch and likely lost. So this is just a really good example of the importance of fish screens.
Now, if you just go back to that just for a second.
Certainly.
So the screen's at the top.
Yeah.
And the reflection's in the middle.
Excuse me?
The reflection is in the middle. So the screen is actually above and below the water, correct?
No, Co-Chair Gilliam, in this case, the water current would be going from the bottom of the screen up. So that's the direction of the current.
Uh-huh.
So down below where you can't see is the diversion in the open river that diverts water into this canal. It will encounter the fish screen and be bypassed right back to the stream.
I see. Okay, thank you.
And we'll have some more pictures of screens later for you. So one of the first questions asked regarding fish screens in Oregon is, are they required? By statute, ODFW does have the authority to require screens at diversions that impact fish, and that's under ORS 498.306. This statute goes on to clarify that screens may be required only if the diversion is over 30 CFS. So CFS, just to clarify, is a cubic foot per second, and that's just a unit of measurement for water. Other fish screen triggers include when there is a new water right is issued for the diversion, the point of diversion is transferred, fewer than 150 projects are voluntarily completed in a biennium, and I'll add that target's been met again this biennium. And lastly, if the fish screening task force has reviewed and approved the department's request to require screening to complete a stream reach. The Fish Screening Task Force is a board appointed by the ODFW Commission. It's made up of 7 members, with 3 representing agriculture, 3 representing fishing or fish conservation, and 1 representing the public at large. This task force typically meets quarterly and advises the department on fish screening program development, funding, monitoring, technology, reporting, and project prioritization. So I'll just clarify on this slide that B and C, the triggers that are related to water rights are commonly issued with a fish screening requirement. As far as water diversions, 30 CFS or more, not meeting the 150 projects per biennium, or the fish screen task force enacting a fish screening requirement, that's been done twice in the history of the program. So there are cases where fish screens are required, but just going out on our own, not associated with a water right or other permitting issue, it's been very rare that we've actually required fish screens. We tend to work on a cooperative basis. And I think it'll be C seized up.
These are night fish screens. All right.
All right, I think we're back in business. I apologize for the delay. The ODFW fish screen program operates largely as an incentive-based program with water users that volunteer for the cost share program. The primary incentives available to assist water users are the ODFW cost share program. This is a cost share program where we're able to fund up to 60% with the maximum of $75,000 on eligible projects. We are able to go over that $75,000 cap with a recommendation from our fish screening task force. So we do go to the task force to consult on larger projects. The remaining 40% is the water user's responsibility and can be contributed in a combination of cash or in-kind assistance. In some cases, federal funds or other non-governmental organizations contribute a portion of the water user's share. Projects that apply for the cost share program are reviewed and prioritized by ODFW fish biologists stationed in the field to ensure funds are allocated to worthy projects that provide a significant benefit to fish. Since this cost share program operates on a cooperative basis, we do not force unwilling water users to enroll in the cost share program. We are able to market the program to high priority basins and projects in hopes of gaining cooperation in the cost share program on those projects that have been identified as extreme high priority. We also have a state tax credit that's available, and it equals 50% of the taxpayer's net certified costs up to a maximum credit of $5,000 per device. This tax credit is set to sunset in January of 2012 and is currently under discussion for extending the sunset. There are also a number of federal programs that periodically are available to assist with fish screen projects as well, and these have been administered through the U.S. Forest Service, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So although ODFW operates largely on a cooperative basis, there are a number of circumstances that result in water users being required to screen. The most common are when someone applies for a new water right or transfers a water right, and the water right action is occurring in an area with fish present. The new water right is typically going to be issued with a condition that requires a fish screen be in place and approved by ODFW. Also, diversions related to hydroelectric projects typically have conditions that require fish screens be in place in order to legally divert water. Additionally, some federal agencies provide financial assistance to private agricultural operations. When those projects involve the irrigation delivery system, they often require a fish screen be in place that meets current criteria.
Can you hold on that slide just for a second? A new water right being triggered, I could probably ask Representative Benz this. Our transferred water right, tell me a little bit about why that triggers it. Is it because when the water right was granted, it was prior to the bill, to the ORS?
Commissioner Gilliam, members of the committee, it can be in both cases. In some cases, the original water right may have had a fish screen requirement. In other cases, you know, we have a lot of water rights in Oregon from the early 1900s. At that point, when those water rights were issued, they didn't have a fish screen requirement on them. Present day now, when they're going to change their system, move their point of diversion, that's an opportune time to include a fish screen on that intake when they're going through the process to move their diversion. So that's, as I showed in statute earlier, that's one of the cases where we are able to include a fish screen requirement. The primary benefits of this program is in the numbers of fish that are protected that otherwise would have been lost at these diversions. Since 2000, over 1,000 screens have been installed with cost share assistance. ODFW has a key performance measure goal of installing at least 150 screens or screening 150 CFS per biennium. As I mentioned earlier, this target has been exceeded again this biennium. Water users also benefit, particularly those diverting out of water that have ESA-listed fish present. Using a criteria fish screen provides a level of protection from federal ESA-related enforcement actions, and the cost share program is able to help reduce the financial burden on these water users that do install fish screens. Another benefit of the program to water users even those that aren't involved in our cost share program, is the technical assistance that we're able to provide water users that are considering installing a fish screen. Our field staff and Salem staff are able to work with private consultants and water users to help develop a fish screen that will work to meet the water users' needs as well as protecting fish at any particular site. Many water users that install a fish screen through the ODFW cost share program also receive assistance with screen maintenance. Fish screens do need routine inspection and maintenance to ensure their continued operation. Water users are responsible for the routine minor maintenance such as inspection, cleaning, and servicing, but major maintenance at diversions under 30 CFS is the responsibility of the department by statute. So those are the smaller diversions that are cost shared through our program. We're responsible for major maintenance. At larger diversions exceeding 30 CFS, the water user is responsible for all the maintenance. And now Ray Harderode is going to take over and describe some of the more common screen types that ODFW cooperates on.
Hold on just a moment. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of flooding going on right now in the John Day and other places, and I'm relatively sure some of these screens are going to be badly damaged and have to be replaced. Where's the money come from to do that, and how long will it take to get to the point of getting that done? And the reason I say that is obvious, because in a month or so, everything will be dry and folks will be wanting to irrigate, and yet these systems will have been, I'm guessing, pretty badly damaged. That's what I heard yesterday anyway. Is that a correct understanding? And if maybe you could respond to what's going to happen now that all those fish screens, all that work, all that money has been ruined by these floods.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Member Betts, Representative Betts, like you are correct, there may be some damage to those screens, and flooding would be something that would be considered major maintenance. A lot of screen components are taken in during the winter, so you know I would hope that in a lot of those sites the screen components weren't present when the flooding occurred. If they're not taking water yet, we receive funds from a number of sources that we use for the major maintenance. Maintenance is a challenge to fund. In the John Day Basin in particular, the Mitchell Act is a program that's administered through the National Marine Fisheries Service, and those funds are distributed as mitigation from the Columbia River dams, and we've been receiving Mitchell Act funds for a number of years that we use those funds for a lot of the maintenance activities. We also have a surcharge on angling licenses that creates the fish screen surcharge. Those funds are also available to be used on maintenance activities. Projects that require a complete replacement would be going through the same funds that our cost share program uses.
Please. Thank you. I guess you may be going into what these actually cost to begin with, the one that was being installed earlier on your slide, what that actually would run. That would be of interest. But before we leave the funding, maybe you could share with us if there's enough money to replace no matter what the damage, or is there some limit?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Benz, the cost of any particular screen is going to be highly variable with the amount of CFS, the amount of water that it takes. The more water it takes, generally the larger the screen is going to be. It's going to be hard for me to estimate how much it's going to cost to replace all those. If funding is limited and we don't have enough funds to replace all of those, what we would likely do is work with our district bios out in there and prioritize which screens are going to be most critical to fish protection and gradually start replacing those that are going to provide the biggest bang and the most protection to fish resources. In the long term, it'll be our responsibility to continue to work to replace those or maintain those to get those functioning. I would hope that most of those wouldn't require a complete replacement to get them working, but replace some components. Lots of the screens have concrete foundations, and hope that that stuff would still be viable, and we just have to replace some screen material that may have been damaged.
Maybe you just give us the least expensive fish screen and the most expensive. Just give us a range.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Benz, the least expensive fish screen are going to be pump screens like we're looking at right now, and they can range, $1,000 begins, at the smallest of those. As far as the most expensive, we're in the $1 million range.
I think now is $18 million.
none of those types of screens are in the John Day Basin. There's a really large fish screen down in the Klamath. There's a large fish screen in Staten that are diverting, you know, lots of water. Most of the screens in the John Day Basin that you're probably talking about, I'm going to say, are going to be in the $20,000 to $40,000 range.
Right.
If it's a large diversion, it would climb above that.
And forgive me, Mr. Chair.
You are forgiven. Go right ahead.
One last question. Because of the salmon runs in the John Day, if these screens are washed out, and if a rancher or farmer wants to divert water, they can't divert water and put those fish down those ditches. Is that a correct statement because of the endangered species issues? Must they have those fish screens in order to divert water?
Co-Chair Gilliam, Representative Bentz, members of the committee, a fish screen may be required on some of those diversions per their water right. Newer water rights or water rights have been transferred. If they have a fish screen requirement on their condition, that may require them to have a screen in place. I'm not aware of ODFW requiring them to screen. I hesitate to speak for NIMS. There currently are screens operating without screens. Certainly not all diversions are screened right now. So folks that had a screen in place and are actively working to replace that screen with us to get that screen functioning again, you know, I would certainly hope if there were any federal enforcement actions, you know, in the works, they would start with the folks that aren't screened currently rather than those that recently suffered a loss and are working to replace that. But I can't speak for NIMS.
NIMS being?
National Marine Fisheries Service.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. I'll have more questions later, I think.
Thank you, Representative. Please go ahead with the second part of the presentation.
Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Ray Hartlerode. I'm the engineering and facilities manager right now, but I've been involved in fish screening since about 1987 with the department. So, long-standing passion of mine, and I've done a lot of work in that area. So, what I was hoping to do is maybe just kind of introduce you to a number of types of screens. Every diversion has its challenges. We have lots of different types of screens we use. One thing that is common to most of the screens is the criteria that we try to adhere to. We try to match the NIMS, National Marine Fisheries Service criteria, so that somebody doesn't voluntarily cooperate with us but then be in trouble with National Marine Fisheries Service. So just a few of those criteria are the hole size, 3/32 of an inch is what's approved. Velocity is very important so that young fish can move away. So the velocity through the screen would need to be less than 0.4 feet per second, and that it be self-cleaning, so that otherwise you would have some portion of the screen plugged with debris, then those velocities are much greater in the rest of the screen, and therefore fish are being impinged. So that's kind of common to most of these screens, except with an exception that I'll get to later. So probably the most common type of screen, we call them pump screens or end-of-pipe screens, and these can be from a few gallon a minute all the way up to, like the Columbia Irrigation District or Potlatch up in Boardman, 500-600 cubic feet per second. But basically similar in type. The one on your left, it uses discharge water from the pump to spray outward and rotate the screen and thereby keeping it clean. The one on the right is out at Dayton, and that's a much larger, about a 60 CFS screen. It uses a water burst, I believe, to keep the screen clean, but it could also be air burst. But typically they're on the end of some type of pipe, either for municipality, irrigation, or industrial uses. For us, this has been a common type of screen, rotary drum screen, since back in the 40s. Many, many rotary drum screens are built in especially eastern Oregon and the Rogue Valley. And it basically here, and that was the picture you saw earlier with the fish in front of it, that was a rotary drum screen. Okay, so water and fish would enter the diversion here. There's a trash rack to keep out the large debris. Currently, this screen is in the up position when they're not taking water, but it would be down against seals on the bottom. And then fish come in and are diverted at an angle through a gate here and then back to the stream. It stays clean because this paddle wheel, which is turned with use of the water flowing through it, turns through a geared system, turns the rotary drum,
and carries the debris over. And that works really well in a gravity feed type system where you're not really care, you don't really care if the debris is in the water. It's, you know, gravity irrigation system that just flood irrigates, debris is not an issue. If you're putting that into a sprinkler system, then that would be an issue. And this would not be the right type of screen.
Hold just a moment.
Yeah.
Our administrator's question.
So when you're showing me, maybe I don't understand, but it looks like the fish are going into the dirt.
Well, yeah, you don't see it, but down underneath here, there's a pipe. That is buried at a specific slope to make it safe for fish back to this stream that you can't really hardly see back here. But no, they're diverted through a pipe. Most of the ones built early in the 40s were these screens were perpendicular here. It made it hard for fish to find the opening back to the stream. So now they're put at an angle. They're swept using the sweeping velocity of the water. And it does take some water to run that bypass and put them back. But no, it's underneath there.
Thank you.
It's a panel screen. So here is the screen material and basically a vertical panel. And these are common, some of the smaller ones, but predominantly large screens. The largest screens in Oregon, the 1100 CFS screen at Staten, Sanium Water Control District, the large A-canal screen in Klamath Falls, those are panel screens such as this. And this is cleaned by this one, a brush system that is on this trolley that goes back and forth and brushes the debris off, and then it's carried away with this sweeping velocity through a bypass down here at the very end and carried through a pipe back to the stream. You mentioned costs earlier. Cost for some of these large ones, like I said, could be as much as $18 million in the case of this BOR screen at the A Canal, but it's a very similar size to the one at Staten where the irrigation district manufactured built the screen themselves. It was approximately $1.6 million. So it makes a difference who's building the screen, too. Really in the repertoire of screens, this is a newer type of screen. It's a belt screen where this belt travels up and over. It's a plastic conveyor material originally used for the food industry for transporting, you know, food materials. Interlox, the company that builds this, worked with ODFW to come up with a special mold that would meet our fish screening criteria, and now they sell that worldwide. Again, this is an instance where the debris is carried over. Now, there are some instances where there will be a box or some method of catching the debris when it comes off the other side. I forgot to mention on the panel screen, you know, a real benefit to those panel screens is debris does not move in through the screen or over the screen, so then it's clean water. So this just rotates and normally carries the debris over as well. And we've used these a lot in John Day where you have high fluctuations in the water surface elevations. If you remember that drum screen, that's a real issue with drum screens. If the water gets too high, it'll flow over the top. If it gets too low, it doesn't clean. So this allows you to have a much greater fluctuation in that water surface elevation and still protect fish. We've also done a lot of these using solar power over in the John Day Basin. This is a unique screen. It's a horizontal screen. Actually, horizontal screens have been around for a long time, but they never worked very well because when water would get low, this whole floor here is a screen. But when water would get low, the water wouldn't carry over the screen, so debris and fish would pile up on top of the screen. Well, the Farmers Irrigation District spent a lot of money and time coming up with something that would be more maintenance-free, no moving parts. And so in this, they taper the wall to keep the water velocities carrying through the screen. They put in a weir wall on this side. So water travels down through the screen, up over this weir, and this weir then fixes the water surface elevation so fish can never be dewatered on the screen. So it's a great screen. It also requires, because there's no cleaning system, the water is the cleaning system, It has a much lower through screen velocity, therefore a much larger footprint. It takes a much bigger screen, and it's really not appropriate where you don't have a lot of water to use for bypass. And here it is dewatered. And so here you can see the screen material, which again is that 3/32 inch hole, this punched stainless, and it tapers down towards the bypass where fish and debris is carried off and back to the stream over here. This one in particular is out at Sio. It's the Lacombe screen. We have one at one of our hatcheries in the Columbia Basin. We've tried a few over in eastern Oregon. Some of them haven't been that successful because of that issue of not having enough water for bypass. But where you have lots of water for bypass, then it's a pretty good screen.
Now, when you do catch somebody from ODF&W like this, do you let them go?
Interesting. This person actually isn't ODFW. It's that Farmers Conservation Alliance that markets this screen. Okay, how we build the screen facilities in Oregon, we try to have a lot of flexibility for the water user landowners. If they have somebody that can build a screen to criteria, we provide the technical assistance, they do it. In many cases, it works better for ODFW to build it, and we do that through our shops in Central Point, the Dalles, John Day, and Enterprise. Interesting enough, these three shops up here were all funded either by BPA or Mitchell Act through National Marine Fisheries Service. All the three of these brand new ones. This shop here primarily constructed with the fish screen surcharge funds. And as you can see, we have a fish screen coordinator in John Day, the Dalles, and Central Point, and they each handle these huge areas that are on the road a lot, and they're the prime ambassadors for screening with the landowners, helping them with the applications to get the grant money, helping them with the technical aspects of what screen works best for them, helping them find other cost share money. If they can't come up with the money themselves, we kind of help them find that through other sources. But those are done out of those three main shops. That was all the photos, but we'd sure be happy to entertain any questions you may have.
Further questions from the committee? We kind of interrupted you with a few during the presentation, so I think we're out of questions.
Okay.
Further, are we set good? Okay.
And one thing I'd like to add, Chair Gilliam and Representative Vance, when you're talking about how to repair these screens in a flood, I just wanted to say that in the past, you know, we've been through other floods since I've worked in screens in the Dalles, John Day, and we've been successful in many of those cases, if there's a disaster declared, to get FEMA money to pay for to replace those screens.
Thank you for your time, and thank you for the presentation. Okay, we're going to go to our second panel, and that's Tom Wolf and Joe Rotender.
Co-chairs, Cannon and Gilliam, committee members. My name is Tom Wolf, chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Joe will talk more about the history of screens. I want to talk a little bit about what groups like Trout Unlimited do to encourage it. First of all, groups like Trout Unlimited recognized very early in the process that fish screens were very important because one of the major cause of demise of young salmon smolts and trout young was getting caught in these canals or concrete passageways and dying there because of insufficient screens. So we operate on three levels as far as Trout Unlimited trying to help with it. On a federal level, back in our office in D.C., we do all we can to go out and get funding for money that will, whether through the Mitchell Act, through FREMA, which is the Fisheries Restoration and Irrigation and Mitigation Act, We go out and make sure that those are included in the budgets so that the money will be available for local farmers and irrigators to have funds available so that they can do the screening they need to do. On a state level, the Oregon Council does two things. We are involved with making sure that ODFW gets enough funding for that, whether supporting the surcharge or other funding applications. And also, on the Fish Screening Task Force, we try to work very hard to make sure that the best possible candidates are appointed to that, because that is a very tough advisory committee and demands a lot of knowledge. We try to make sure that who's ever on that committee has a lot of knowledge and can really make astute judgments on screen applications. And finally, on the local level, whether it's through the chapter or some of the projects we're doing led by national staff in Central Oregon and on the North Coast, we try to work closely with irrigators, farmers, to help them with funding to provide support that we can, and do something that we've even spent some extra funds on is monitoring the impact, monitoring the amount of fish that survive due to those fish screening, monitoring how effective some of those fish screenings we do. We don't do that as much in Oregon as we've done in other parts of the country, but we find that a very effective way to measure the success of fish screens, because sometimes if the fish screens are not very successful and literally are not doing the required job, they can be responsible for killing a lot of fish, and there's no monitoring. So we try to do funding to do monitoring projects on those. So, and just in closing, and I'll give some of the history to Joe, but all the fish groups, whether it's Trout Unlimited, Native Fish Society, we recognize the importance of fish screens, and it is a key part, and we support wholeheartedly local irrigators and farmers who are working hard to provide fish screens, to the state agencies like ODFW that are working hard on those, and to all federal agencies. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Joe. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollater. I represent the McKinsey River Guides Association and Seafood Oregon. Seafood Oregon is a commodity commission's that harvest fish on the ocean. I've been involved in this since the mid-80s. At various times in the past, there have been some regulations that required screenings, and sometimes they weren't. The ORSs that we started with in 1991, when we started to work with this cooperative screening program, came from two directions. The Fish and Wildlife Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, which is administered by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, came from two different agencies in 1976 that were combined. And the ORSs weren't really combined together. So in some cases, people were required to screen. In some cases, they were required to have passage. However, there really wasn't a lot of enforcement, and there wasn't the technology to do these things. So when we started in 91, as Tom said, the conservation groups, ag groups, timber, fishermen got together and said, we really need to do something about this, to create a program to save these fish. You're impacting fish that have sometimes been in the gravel for 1 to 2 years. You worked really hard to get the adults up there to spawn. The fish have been exposed to a lot of mortality that they're getting pretty close to the end of the big mortality. They go to the ocean and then they grow up and come back. So these are very valuable fish. And I think it's a really good investment to protect these fish as they're migrating back out to the ocean. In 1991, we started a program with $440,000 of general fund money per biennia, and we also put on ourselves, the fishing community put on themselves, a license fee surcharge of 25 cents per general license. So if you bought a trout license or a salmon license or whatever, you had to buy a general license, it was 25 cents. So at the time, the two funds were about the same. Nowadays, we put a 75-cent license, 75-cent surcharge. You heard about the surcharge money. 75 cents on every fishing license generates $1.4 million a biennia. As I said before, this has become a voluntary program. We try to work with a combination of three different kinds of money: fishing license fees, contributions from the irrigator, and money from the government. Right now we've got some different forms of government money. The general fund has all gone away. We've got approximately, as I said, $1.4 million from the license fee surcharge. We've got about $3-plus million from Mitchell Fund, which is an act that was set up in 1939 to mitigate loss of fisheries because of the Columbia River Dam system. We get $3 to $4 million a biennia from lottery, and we also get about $1 million a biennia from BPA and a small amount of money from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So when we started this, we looked at it as a really good investment to protect our fish when they're being impacted at one point. And I look at this now, and it's kind of the same program we're in with predators. We have begun to recognize that predation is taking place just as these fish are headed towards the ocean. And so I think we'll probably do the same thing. We'll figure out what the situation is. We'll develop some tools to lessen that predation, and then we'll figure out a way to pay for it. So I'm pretty optimistic. I think this program has been very, very good. Thank you.
Joe, when we talk about the history,
mm-hmm.
I know it's probably impossible to know how many fish we were losing. Is there a ballpark of percentage? How do we know how significant it was? I don't doubt that it was significant. I don't doubt that the hydroelectric system contributed to it. I don't doubt that we need it for the irrigation. But how big of a problem was it, say, at different milestones in the 30s and then with the major statutory change in the 90s and so forth?
Chair Gilliam, I think that that's a question I've asked myself many times, because we wanted to show a cost-benefit ratio when we started this program. And it's a very difficult number to grab a hold of. But as of, for instance, some places, the water withdrawal is faster than the mainstream, so the fish are attracted to it. When they're migrating downstream, they like to go the fastest place. And they went down and were either pumped out onto a field or got stuck in an irrigation. So in some cases, it was 100% mortality. In other places, the irrigation withdrawals were minor, or there was some screening. On the Rogue, I do know that when we started talking about Savage Rapids, the big issue there with out-migrating fish was it was under-screened. There were big holes in the screen. There were big gaps between the screen and the side. And the biologists at ODF&W told us that about 25% of the out-migrating salmon and steelhead were going out into the Grants Pass Irrigation District and just disappearing. I don't know what that number is. I think it's one of those vague numbers. I think it's a pretty big number, though.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think these questions are probably for the previous panel, but they've been prompted by what we just heard. So I'll ask you, and if you can answer, great. I think in some of the previous bills we heard this session, we heard the number of fish screens that are needed and then the number of fish screens that have been installed. So in your opinion, are we making progress, and what grade would you give the state for its efforts over the past 20 years since the fish passage work was initiated that you were talking about?
Co-chairs, Representative Bentz, I was on the fish screening task force for a while, so I kind of got some of this information in my head. One of the first things we did in the 90s was inventory all the unscreened diversions, and we didn't try to rate them or prioritize them in any way. We found we had about 10,000 unscreened diversions in Oregon. Some of those weren't on anadromous streams. Some of them were in places that were really critical. So we started to do a priority. We found that we came up with a list of about 1,000 priority screens. And then I think there was a second list of about 3,000 priority screens. And as you've heard, we do 150 or so a biennia. I think that's good progress. I think it's really important that the priority system work right. For instance, you heard a bill about in-stream hydro. I would think that we'd need to work something out to make sure that if an in-stream hydro project were anticipated, it would immediately go to the top of the priority. ODFW never works fast enough for me. I'm always critical about the progress that they make. But in this case, I think that it's been a good program and it's been worth the money. How many places we screen depends on how much money we can come up to help the irrigators or the water withdrawer people to get this technology, to install it, and to maintain it.
You're getting nods on all points behind you, by the way. Representative Vance.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I recall correctly, the $10,000 item, many of those were culverts and not just diversions in the classic sense. That may be a passage issue that I'm recalling now instead of the fish screen issue. But to go back to the fish screen, this is to build on the co-chair's question, which was, how do we measure the good that's been done as a result of the fish screens that have so far been installed? In other words, do we have twice as many fish now as we used to have? How do we put a label on that, which we've already done? How do we measure our progress?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bent, I don't know how to do that. I know that intuitively I see these fish that are not being sucked down the canal, but at the same time, there's so many other pressures. One of them that's grown a lot is predators. There's also ocean conditions to think about. And I just have this gut feeling, having worked with this for a long time, that it's better than it would have been without it.
Follow up.
Please do.
And you are touching upon exactly the issue I was wanting to get to,
yeah.
And that is, should we redirect our efforts to something that is more cost-benefit weighted than fish screens? That's my question. And how do we get there? Is the OIDFW doing a good job of it?
Okay, go ahead.
That's my question.
Tom,
co-chairs Gilliam and Canham, Representative Vince, I want to take this one. I've been working in the fish in the conservation industry for about 20 years, and I think it's dangerous to try to decide which program is working and which isn't working. I think that for the cost benefit and for the amount of money put in, the fish screening effort is very effective, and I think it would be dangerous for us to look out there and think that there's something we could spend more money on. It would be, I think it's very, a very cost benefit system that protects lots of fish, and I don't, you know, no one knows the numbers, so I guess that's my answer. I don't know if that helps.
Hold on, Mr. Chair.
Please do.
I would just say that given our challenged economic situation and budget situation, I think we're going to be forced to do those kinds of weighing and balancing. No, notwithstanding the good that the fish screening's done, that's not to suggest it hasn't done a good. It just is that maybe focusing on pinnipeds or on cormorants, where those birds are, we keep hearing about, maybe that would be far more effective, maybe not. I just want to make sure we're looking at those kinds of issues and reaching an appropriate decision on how we invest scarce resources.
Co-chairs Gilliam and Cannon, Representative Bent, those are questions that we in the fish conservation community wrestle with every day. So, and I don't have a good answer for you.
Representative Krieger, please.
Yeah. Things Representative Bent brought up cormorants. We're having a work group on cormorants tomorrow. Representative Bent, you ought to drop by. We've been working on it for 2 years. We will get to management over time, but they're taking 50%. Roughly 50% on BERT, give or take. And I don't know any place that you could do more good quicker than there. Joe, you and I had talked about, and I mentioned it to Kurt earlier, he'd left, the bill we passed out on the generation on these small projects, and it's hung up over in the Senate, and I understand, you know, to some degree, the mm-hmm. difference of opinion. We're talking, and you and I talked about the possibility of up front the department screening these devices, but requiring actually in statute to get the permit that they may have to, from the generation dollars, at maybe 5% of the generation dollars, to go to pay for their share of a screen. And then we would also have some of the money, of course, coming from the Department of Fish and Wildlife and OWEB, so there'd be about three places that we could get funds to make sure those are, if we prioritize them. I had a small hydro plant. Mine doesn't have to be screened because it comes out of a trout pond on my ranch, but I think there's a willingness of most farmers and ranchers to contribute to not having fish go down these things. And if they're going to get a benefit, they don't have to have the money up front. The state's going to pay it, and the generation is going to pay it back over time, 5% of the generation per month. It wouldn't take that long to do it, yet it wouldn't impact the validity or the feasibility of a project. Could you comment on that concept?
Co-chairs, Representative Crater, I think it's, you know, I'm an old man now, and I was a lot younger when I started this. I had a lot more energy, but I think those are questions we always need to continue to answer. How can we make this program work better? And some kind of revolving fund where part of the money came from the power that was being generated for the next screen that came along might be a really good way to look at. Unfortunately, every time the fishing and the conservation community come up here and talk about some innovative program like that, it's got a big fiscal and we can't move it through. But I think there's a way, and I think to follow up on Representative Bence's question, I think we need to continue to look at where our government dollars are being spent, where our user dollars are being spent, and try to use them most effectively to return the most number of fish back for us to play with. So,
please, follow up. You like that?
He plays with fish while I'm here.
I know how painful that must be for you. Any other comments or questions to these two gentlemen? If not, thank you for your testimony.
I missed a clam tide this morning, too.
Well, thanks for being here. We appreciate the sacrifice. Our last panel has four members. I'll call you up two at a time. Anita Winkler and Jeff Light. Late. Sorry. And Anita, maybe Anita's here.
So it's a little bit.
Is Julie Kyle in the room?
No, she's not able to be here.
Then I'm going to ask Sean Cleave to come up and join the panel, and that'll complete the last panel.
Break the panel.
No, he's going to do it.
I'll go ahead and start while Sue's trying to get the technology working. I don't need it right at the very start.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee, I'm Anita Winkler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. And I'm pleased to be here. Thank you for having this hearing, and thank you for giving us a chance to be part of it. The group here, of this panelist, are from the natural resources community, and only a small part of that community. But more importantly, we're a small fraction of the business and industry community in this state that work with ODF&W to protect fish. And I want to tell you a little bit about what our members have been doing in the fish passage and the fish screening arena. But I want you to know that as we were setting this up, I was tasked with calling some other people to get a broader representation at this panel, including Julie Kyle. Unfortunately, when I called those people, they couldn't change their schedules in 2 or 3 days to be here. But it was people from the industries, municipalities, utilities, and county roads. And they all expressed interest in continuing this discussion with you, given an opportunity later on. So as both Kurt and Alan explained, there's two different parts of fish protection, at least how I see it, and I will admit I have a fairly simplified view of this because I have to get it in my head at times. Fish screen and fish passage. They're two very distinct parts. They serve two very different purposes, but they are very much related to each other. Fish screens, as you've seen, keep fish from going where you don't want them to go, into the irrigation canals or into other diversions. Fish passage help fish go where you want them to go, get over barriers to move up and down a stream. So two very different things. I'm going to talk first about fish screens. And I actually, and I'll have a little bit, I have to compete with Fish and Wildlife. I even have my own set of pictures when we get there. So, but I want to make clear that I am representing irrigation districts and water control districts, the big diverters, the big water delivery systems for agriculture in this state. I'm not representing individual irrigators. And Sean's here to talk about their needs. They're very different. We have much, much bigger diversions. We take a lot of water at the time out of the stream, and they're fairly sophisticated delivery systems that run many, 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 many miles. We have been canvassing our members, which basically, first off, was the dumbest idea I've had in a long time to try and do this time of year because they're all out trying to get their delivery systems running. Ordinarily, not a bad time of year, but they all have too much water right now, so it's been a little bit difficult to get answers. So the information I have for you is somewhat incomplete, but I'll give you the best that I do have. We're estimating that the number of diversions operated by our members is somewhere in the 100 to 150 diversions range.
If you can now, push that mic, just they're very sensitive. It's kind of a problem.
Too close?
Just, yeah, exactly.
Okay. That better?
Thank you. Yeah,
okay.
Perfect.
Mostly, those screens are mostly installed voluntarily, and a few have been installed as a result of different legal action, but they're mostly put in because it's the right thing to do. Several of them, many of them, are operated by the federal government through the Bureau of Reclamation. The districts manage them. They vary in size from 5 CFS, which is not very much water, actually. They're pretty small, to 1,650 was the largest one that's been reported to me. That is a lot of water to be moving. The ones that are not screened right now, about now 10-15% of the total diversions, tend to be on very small streams and very small diversions in that 5 CFS or smaller. And I am told that they're on non-fish-bearing streams for the most part. The cost of the screens range from $75,000 for a screen that was built several years ago and obviously is not a very large screen, to the kind of granddaddy of them all in Klamath was a $15 million fish screen built by the Bureau of Reclamation after that system was shut down. The cost is largely a function of the size of the diversion, the speed of the water, and the other conditions in the stream where you're going to place that big piece of, basically it's a big piece of equipment, it's a big structure. I don't know the total amount our districts have invested because, first off, I don't have everybody reporting yet. Secondly, a lot of expenses were built into reclamation programs, and they're part of a repayment contract that the districts have to repay reclamation. And over the years, those get amended as things happen, and we literally don't have the records to isolate the cost of the fish screen. And then in a few other instances, they've been part of a huge program to do other habitat restoration or other considerations. For example, the Savage Rapids Dam removal. That's, you know, a $38 million plus project, and the fish screen's a part of that, but it's certainly not the $38 million. So our rough estimate is our districts have invested something in the neighborhood of $80 million plus since they've been around, which would be the oldest one's about 75 years old, but in the last, you know, 50 or so years, $80 million in fish screens. Some of those are getting to the point they're going to get to be replaced or need to be replaced, so that number will continue to rise. The funding comes, I think when I was tallying up the report, 15 different sources that the districts have tapped right now. Federal government through U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Reclamation, FEMA, which somebody mentioned earlier, U.S. Fish and Wildlife through their FREMA program, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, Department of Agriculture, Vaunabill Power Administration. Now, what's scary for me as I was doing testimony on federal budgets this year, many of those programs are targeted for significant cuts, and significant with a capital S. In the FY12 budget. Some already were cut in this year's budget with the federal government. Some may even be targeted for elimination. So we don't really know what's going to be around in the next few years to help with these programs. At the state level, Fish and Wildlife already talked about their programs, and the other one that the districts have used is OWEB, generally through their watershed councils. Several have used different nonprofit organizations around the state through watershed councils or through other shared efforts. In some occasions, the tribes have helped cover it. And then the last one is the district patrons through their assessments, and often just in-kind labor to build these things. Many of those sources have limits on the funding, as any government program does. There's always requirements and limits. Some it's a cap. Alan mentioned the $75,000 cap with the chance to expand that some in the cost share program with ODF&W. In some cases, they can't be used if it's a mandatory, not mandatory because all water rights are supposed to have diversions, but something else has happened to trigger the requirement for fish screen or fish passage. The funding can't be used in that kind of instance. Some require they be part of a water conservation program or some habitat restoration program. Almost all require some sort of a local match. The question becomes, why are fish screens so expensive? And when I started this job almost 10 years ago, somebody said a fish screen, and I grew up in the city, and I grew up in southern Idaho where you didn't really talk about fish screens very much at that time. And I'm thinking, you get this screen, and you somehow attach it to the pipe, or you attach it to the head gate, and it works. Well, my board of directors set me straight pretty fast. These are incredibly complicated pieces of equipment, and they are very, very, very large. So I brought along a couple of pictures because I always need visuals to get size. This is Central Oregon Irrigation District's fish screen under construction. This is their fish screen near downtown Bend. And I sort of like some of these because we got people in them, and you can see how little the people are when you see it. This reminds me of when I saw the Klamath fish screen being built and saw the guy standing in that, and I thought, my gosh, this thing is just unbelievably large, and it was much, much bigger than this. This is a vertical screen diversion. Alan explained some of this with brushes that run up and down and clean the screen. They're generally built really wide at one end, and they get narrow at the other end. It has to do with how the fish move through and how you move the water through, and it's engineering beyond my understanding. But this does include a feature that channels the fish back to the river. They showed you that with the drum screen, but all these screens have to have that. You get the fish in there, you got to get them out somehow. The screens total 150 feet in length. The bypass itself is another 50 feet long, goes down to the Deschutes River. It was a $2.2 million project funded through ODF&W, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, a cash and in-kind contributions from three different districts. Excuse me. This is the screen in operation. Don't look very big when it's actually operating. It's just kind of a big wide piece of water with some equipment in it. We don't know who this is. We have a couple of ideas of who the person is standing there, but we didn't check to find out for sure, so I won't tell any tales. But you can just see how it gets wider and narrower and works its way down. I don't have a picture here that shows the fish bypass.
I think it's the chair of the committee without his toupee.
I'm sorry?
I think it's the chair.
I'm sorry, I asked the second question.
Which one?
Either one.
This is a very recent picture. This is Three Sisters Irrigation District out near Sisters. It's a much smaller district. They are building, this is the construction of what we call the Farmers Irrigation District screen, or the Farmers screen. Horizontal screen. ODF&W showed you one of these and how they worked. This is actually a massive project that includes huge restoration. They returned the stream to its original channel. It had been rechanneled by the Army Corps to prevent flooding. So they moved it back into its original channel and built this thing. That's some real happy guys working in that snow this winter to get it open. The cost of this one is $1.3 million. It has OWEB money, NIFWIF, which
National Fish and Wildlife Foundation.
National Fish and Wildlife Foundation channels a lot of federal money. U.S. Forest Service, Reclamations, Water Smart Program, and District In-Kind Labor. District did almost all the labor on this themselves.
The first one was Bend. This one was?
Three Sisters.
Three Sisters.
This one is 240 feet long, 40 feet wide, and it's the largest type of this diversion in the state of Oregon. And that is in operation. This happened 2 weeks ago. They went into service. I was talking to the manager one day on the phone, and he was just all but chortling because he got to walk across his fish screen as it was operating. He was a happy guy. This is Santiam Water Control's fish screen. This is, again, the vertical panels. And the reason I wanted to show this one to you, first off, it gives a great picture, 40 feet wide at one end and 3 feet wide at the other. If you look down at the far end, you see a pipe going crosswise. Do you see where I'm talking about? It extends out at the far end. That pipe travels, I want to make sure I get this right, 600 feet to return fish to the river. So when the fish get in here, this is a debris rack right at the front end. If fish get in there, then their channel does this gets narrower and narrower and narrower because you got to convince the fish to go down that far and go down to that end, and you force them in. It goes through that pipe and on out to the river where they're discharged and they go on their way. This one was $1.8 million with U.S. Fish and Wildlife FEMA money, Department of Fish and Wildlife, several municipal partners, and NRCS through the Department of Agriculture. The district itself put up over $500,000 plus $126,000 in kind. The last fish screen is, this is Arnold Irrigation District. It's a fairly small district, also out in central Oregon. And I included it not because there's anything different about the fish screen, but their fish return, and actually their manager calls it their fish escape. It's 1,000 feet long to get back to the river. The total project was about $500,000. They had $54,000 from Fish and Wildlife, and the district paid for the rest of it. District patrons paid for the rest of it. With some recent conversations, one of our district managers said that fish screens are probably the most expensive piece of equipment and the most complicated piece of equipment in a district. The brushes go continually when the water is flowing to keep the debris off. You have to make sure that the trash racks are clear, and boy, it's amazing how much trash gets in there and just accumulates on top of those racks. But they're a very, very complicated piece of equipment, not anything like I thought. It was just like a screen door at my house. I want to show you a little bit about fish passage as well. We don't have a lot of information about fish passage as far as our district. But when I say fish passage, probably the thing most familiar to you is if you've been up to the Bonneville Dam and you can see the fish passage through there. It's sort of become renowned as being the target for sea lions from California to come up and feed before they head back to California. Part of the problem in collecting information from our members about fish passage is that many of the fish passages now in place were built by parties other than the district, so we can't get any of the numbers about what they cost and how effective they are, how long they've been there. I just don't know anything about them. In many instances, the fish barriers are not owned by the districts. They're owned by the Bureau. They're owned by private parties. The districts may manage them, but districts never assumed they'd have any responsibility for that fish passage, so they've not even begun to evaluate what it's going to cost to build it across that diversion. And for those who started looking at this, they just haven't completed the feasibility studies or the engineering design yet, so we don't have estimates of the cost. I think also one of the other problems is fish passage has been around a long time in Oregon, but the active program at Fish and Wildlife is new in the last 10 or so years. What I'm telling you is anecdotal for what our districts have told us. I've not been very involved in this program. But one of our district managers described the fish passage program as somewhat mystical. And if you knew this manager, you'd even appreciate it more that he said it that way. But he said, you know, things that he talked about is that nobody really knows when you need fish passage. Do you need it when you have two waterfalls back to back that are 3 foot high, or do you only need it when you have a 6 foot high? Or do you need it for 1 foot? Do you need it when you've got a whole bunch, when you've got bunches of little pieces because the fish were up going up bunches of little ones? It's a developing science as near as I can tell. Then they've run into some other problems about what even attracts fish to the fish passage. And people talked earlier about how do you get the fish to go where you want them to go. You know, it's not like you can have somebody down there herding them. And fish just have their reasons. I don't think we fully understand them as a species about where they want to go. But somehow you have to get them to the fish passage to get them to go through it, or it's not useful. And so we haven't quite figured all of that out. We, as an organization, have been, it's not clear to us about the criteria used for setting the priorities and how that priority list is used in moving through the fish passage needs in the state. And a couple of our districts have had to confront a fish passage requirement, and from what they told me, the funding is not nearly as available for fish passage as it is for fish screen, with projects that are significantly more expensive than fish screens are. I don't think that's an insolvable problem. It's certainly more solvable would be that the state or the federal government were not in the financial situation we're in, but it is something we're going to need to tackle. I haven't canvassed, and our staff has not canvassed those programs to find out if fish screen programs can be used to fund fish passage. The only one I know anything about is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife FREMA, the Fishery Restoration Irrigation Mitigation Act, because that was our bill. We asked it be introduced in Congress. We were the ones who worked to get it through for the first authorization. We got it reauthorized. What little bit of money we've been able to get, we have been in the lead. I'm sorry to say that while it's authorized at $25 million a year, we've never seen more than $3 or $4 or $5 million in any one year. And I think it's not been funded for the last 3 years, so it's not a particularly helpful program for us right now. Again, I just want to show you a couple of pictures that I know about of fish passage involved with districts. I think this one, just when I was out and saw this just caught my fancy. The front part of that's fish passage, the part with the kind of stepped up pieces. This is getting over a dam. It's between the Umatilla River and the Cold Springs Reservoir, built as part of the Umatilla Exchange Project, which is a very complicated project of trading water from Umatilla and the Columbia River, out obviously in the Umatilla Basin. That entire exchange project was a $68 million project, but that wasn't the cost of this fish passage. It was some part of that. We just don't know the exact amount. It was built by the Bureau of Reclamation and funded by BPA. It's the kind of thing, when we were out there that day, and it was just kind of like, you want to just sit down and enjoy the stream, because it was this great, flowing, you know, noisy thing that you think about with streams and rivers. It's just, I think, a beautiful fish passage that's probably the exception and not the rule. This is at Ochoco Irrigation District near Prineville. They built this fish passage. It's on the Mackay Creek. And at the front end, you can see some boards there, and where those... And then you can see slots in it all the way through. The boards aren't in there. It's not an operating passage right now. But in each of those slots, a different board goes with a different level of the cut. So if you could stand and look at it straight on, you'd see them just building on each other kind of like a set of stairs, and it becomes that typical kind of fish passage where it gets a little deeper with each chamber, and the fish can move through it that way. The irrigation district built this themselves, and I actually don't have the cost for the construction of that. It was just built last summer, I believe. A year ago, went into operation last irrigation season. So that's kind of our picture of what we see with fish screen and fish passage. We think this is, I think this hearing is extraordinary. I really appreciate that you all want to spend time understanding what's going on in these programs. We have had a very good working relationship with Fish and Wildlife since before I came on board. I've appreciated their staff. And they were partners with us in getting FREMA through Congress, and have been partners for us in funding many of our district projects. We want to work with them, and we want to work with you, sort of figuring out how this program plays out and where it ought to be in Oregon's priorities.
Thank you for coming and for that presentation.
Okay. Mr. Chairs and representatives, my name is Jeff Light. I'm with Plum Creek Timber Company, and I'm here to talk to you exclusively about fish passage, and specifically about getting fish upstream through corrugated metal pipes that are common to forest roads and county roads and things that you're familiar with driving around out there. Okay, as background, blockages of fish movement upstream is definitely a serious issue. It's a legitimate concern, and if you think about the dams in the Columbia River blocking all those many, many miles of spawning habitat and salmon trying to return upstream to reproduce and all that happened with those impassable dams that were put in place, it certainly is worthy of concern, and it has generated a lot of interest and energy to try to rectify that. There are some recent publications that came across here in British Columbia. They did a survey of their forest roads principally, and also county roads, I believe, and they found that fish crossings may be the single most important habitat impact affecting fish. In the Tongass National Forest in Alaska, 85% of the culverts crossing resident fish streams are assumed not to be adequate for fish passage. These are just two excerpts from similar studies where people have gone around and measured culverts and other stream crossing structures and evaluated them using the current criteria, and have come out generally with most everything being a barrier to fish, which leads to some pretty alarming statements. The problem is that many of these stream crossing structures occur in not the anadromous salmonid realm, but in the resident trout realm. In particular, on forest roads, in the headwaters of streams, there are smaller streams, there are steeper streams, and they're principally the fish that is typically up there is a resident cutthroat trout or a rainbow, perhaps. And this is the very common thing that we encounter. The current passage criteria for the evaluating crossing structures and fixing them is that if you have more than 1% slope in your pipe and it's more than 8/10 of a foot drop on the downslope end, that it is considered a barrier. So with those criteria, you end up getting most pipes as being regarded as barriers. And the solutions are pretty costly. You go from, ideally, if you're going to achieve those kind of criteria, you're going to put in a pipe that is either a stream simulation where it's buried so deep that the substrate is in the stream and it looks to all purposes like a stream, and then or bridges. And those were obviously expensive as well, and I'll show you in a sec. So if you were to tally up all those crossing structures that were cited in that paper, it's definitely a multi-billion dollar fix. If you're going to go about putting all those pipes in to get the fish past, it's going to be very expensive. So in my view, you ought to get it right in terms of evaluating what's a barrier and then how do you fix them. So that's kind of what this is about. Here's an example that got me into this. Our foresters had pipes like these that were considered barriers. If you run the numbers, there's a time of year in which the speed of the water through this pipe is too swift to allow fish to pass, so it would be regarded as a barrier, even though to the casual eye you'd say, really? So when you go back to the literature and the science behind fish passage, you try to understand what guides the criteria, and you find out that it's was typically a marriage of hydrologists and pipe hydraulics with lab studies of fish in tubes to see how fast they could swim, and you put those two together to figure out how fast the water is in a pipe, and when it's too fast for the fish to swim, you end up getting the pipe regarded as a barrier. And that's kind of the basis of a lot of our criteria today and what led us to do this research I'm going to tell you about. This is an example of just showing you kind of how non-trivial these costs are. It's an Oregon Coast Range stream. It's a 13-foot wide channel, about 4% gradient. So if you put your pipe at grade, it's more than 1%, it's a barrier. If you were to just put a 54-inch pipe to get the water through it and protect the road, you'd cost you about six grand to do that. If you were to put one that's a bank full width pipe and or bury that partially so as to allow for a little stream bed in there, it would be around $35,000. And if you were to put a concrete bridge in, you're up to $60,000. And then if you were to put a bridge into, say, Forest Service spec, you're probably, another three, four times that, just because they have different criteria. So this is on a single pipe in a single crossing. You need to multiply that times all the number of crossings out there. It adds up in a hurry. So the solution, I think, is that you need to develop some credible science on what can fish really pass in the wild for real, and when do they need to pass. So it's not just a matter of what they're capable of, but it also is, when do they try to move up a pipe? Is it at all flows, like this flood in the background of this picture, or is it other times a year that the flows are more amenable to movement? Is that when they go? And then again, what happens if they can't make it up the pipe? Is it a tilt? Does the population go away? Are there some genetic issues? What's really going on? And today I'm going to talk to you about the part about what can fish pass, their capability in moving through pipes. And to do this work, we used a covert test facility that's in a hatchery, the Skookum Hatchery, out of Tenino, Washington. This thing was constructed with funds that a lot of the DOTs up and down the coast from California to Alaska put together about 10 years ago, spent a couple of million bucks building this thing, and it was trying to look at whether juvenile fish could move through pipes, juvenile coho particularly, could move through these pipes. And of course, the DOTs have these very long pipes through highways and stuff, and it was a big issue. So they built this thing. It's maybe not so easy to see. I'll turn that to Zappy here. There is a culvert, a standard 40-foot culvert, a corrugated metal pipe. That's a 6-foot diameter one. The water comes in here. It's loaded, and you can control the flows that go through that pipe. There's a holding tank and a receiving tank. And then you can, on that gurney there, you can hoist that pipe up to a different slope. So you can change the slope, and you can change the flow, and it's an actual culvert. And then there's a tank below there. You put fish in there. This is the hatchery back there. And then you can measure the fish movement up into the holding tank at the top. So it's really slick system for seeing what fish can do. And we chose to tackle this. We did a pilot in 2009 and one in a full test last year.
I want to be sure we have time for Sean and the rest of your presentation. How are you doing?
Good.
Are you doing all right?
Yep. I'll be wrapping it up soon. We're into results.
Yeah. All right.
So when the early work on that pipe was just done, the pipe I just showed you, that facility, the critical thing they found was is that there's, when water goes through a pipe, there's what I call a sweet spot, and it's in this place in a pipe. If you're looking down the pipe, you can see how the flow's kind of on one side of the pipe, and it's not so swift in the other. That's because the corrugations in the pipe cause a boundary layer that makes it slower on one side, and they witnessed through video cameras the fish moving up through that sweet spot. So that was interesting. So we wanted to see if what would happen if we put wild cutthroat in there. And what we did is we caught them in the wild above, in the watershed above that facility. We put pit tags in them, these tags here, that allow you to tell exactly which fish it is that you tagged. And it gives you a measure of which ones actually tried to get up the pipe. We put them in the outlet tank. We set them there for 2 nights. We watched what they could do. And then we move the slope of the pipe and the flow through the pipe to vary the speed of the water in there and saw what happened. Okay, here's the results. This blue bar represents participation. It means the fish with tags that entered the pipe to try to get up it. And you can see that in these first few trials, this is the velocity in the bottom, this is the proportion of fish that in the blue either tried, or in the green, of those that tried, the ones that made it. So you'll see here, 96% tried, and 100% of those that tried made it in this trial. And this is a trial at 2 feet per second, 2.5, and 3 feet per second. So lots of fish tried. This is all on their own, and most made it. Now, 4 feet per second is the magic boundary at which the belief was that fish are no longer capable from those lab studies of making it upstream very fast. So in the next trial, we were like, uh-oh. You know what? Those are right. Look at that. Suddenly we got a diminishment of the number of fish that tried, and then of those, only 61% made it. So we went ahead and increased the flow to speed to 5 feet per second, and on to 8 feet per second. And you can see that across the board, both the participation resumed at high levels, although it diminished by the time we got out to 8 feet per second. This pipe is at 8.5% slope, so way steeper than 1%, and a flow of about up to 14 CFS. So you can see that it varied, but still quite a few fish made it through that pipe. Even a third of the fish made it through that very steep pipe at that fairly significant flow. So, wow, that was pretty amazing. Here's the key thing, and this is your decision space. Well, first I got to show you this video. This is that steep pipe setting, 8 cubic feet per second, and the velocity was 7 feet per second. Of course, never does this right. So.
Try the backspace key.
Backspace. Nope, not going to do it. This always happens.
Kind of like a culvert.
Yeah, kind of like just whenever you want them to work, they don't. So anyway, if you had seen this video, you would have seen a fish go zipping up the side of the pipe in that sweet spot just as easy as you please. Anyway, this is the rendering of all that results into a probability of passage curve. And this is what I view as a decision space. If you have the probability of passage on the left, you've got the velocity of the water on the right. We turn those numbers on participation and success into a probability curve statistically that gives you an idea that if you have the water at 4 feet per second, you're going to get 80% of your fish through that pipe. If you go to 8 feet per second, you're going to get about a third of your fish through that pipe. So it tells you that you guys get to make the decisions on that, but you could base criteria on passage, both evaluating pipes and fixing pipes, depending upon in your balance of cost versus benefit, where you want to be on this chart in terms of fish passage and fish probability of passage. So the next steps are to publish our results this year. We want to do further tests for that facility because it's there, and we want to do some validation in pipes in the woods. We want to try other culvert sizes and shapes. We want to try looking at the effect of that outlet height, the jump height, try different species, and then get into the ecology questions of when do they need to pass and what happens when they can't. So are there any questions?
We'll hold questions for this panel until Sean's had a chance.
Certainly.
But if you just hang with us, Sean's our last testifier. Sean, I'm going to ask you to identify for the record, and also, if you would, say fish passage three times quickly.
For the record, Chair Gilliam and Chair Cannon, fish passage.
Thank you very much.
As good as I can do. Thank you very much. Again, Sean Cleave, representing Oregon Farm Bureau, filling in for Ms. Fast, who has a sick child at home. This is more of her issue area. I'll just say that from the perspective of many members of the Farm Bureau, one in particular who lives out in the Solvies Valley, who I had the pleasure of touring his ranch this past year, there are some barriers to expense when consulting with ODF&W for some of these smaller fish screens. This particular member had five small projects that he was installing, and when he talked to the department, the cost estimate was $40,000 to $50,000. This particular member also has a good relationship with OSU, and he consulted with some faculty from the department and was able to design and build effective fish screens on his property for about $5,000 a piece. Now, granted, these are about one quarter of the size of some of the larger projects that Ms. Winkler demonstrated in her PowerPoint. Sorry I didn't have time to put one together for you today, but when we talk about cost-benefit, I think from the perspective of many farmers across Oregon, for some of these smaller projects, the cost becomes a barrier. And a lot of them do want to be good stewards of the land and the environment, and they select amongst their own accord and use money out of their own pocket to install these. So with that, I'll wrap up my testimony.
Good.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And somebody just walked in who might be able to answer the question, but there's been a lot of talk about cost sharing, and has OWEB been included in these conversations?
I'm not sure that I'm the best person to answer it either, but my understanding is that OWEB generally works through their watershed councils as opposed to direct grants, but that's about all I know about OWEB money.
Then how about soil and water districts?
I have not heard of the districts themselves having the funding. I've heard of them being part of the partnerships on the projects that help secure the funding and move it forward.
Okay. I just wanted to get that on the record because those are two of the entities that seem to have money for projects to work with for fish. It might be interesting to find out how involved they are or could be.
Thank you, Representative. Seeing no other questions or comments, I'm going to thank you all three for coming as well. We appreciate all of our testifiers today. And I'm going to close our informational meeting hearing on fish screens. And I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 82A. And Co-Chair Cannon, do you want to say a few
words? I'll just say it from here rather than going to the dais. We don't have a lot of time. We have four folks to testify. But I just did want to give the committee a very brief bit of background on this bill. As you may recall, in 2007, we passed House Bill 2626 to establish the Oregon eCycles program. The problem that addressed was the problem of how to recycle electronic waste affordably, how to do so conveniently, and there weren't many good options for Oregonians. That bill resulted from an effort by the manufacturers to help work with legislators on a solution to the problem. As a result of that bill, manufacturers are paying a fee. They're funding a program that they help operate in some cases, or pay the state to operate to establish collection and redemption sites for electronic waste throughout the state of Oregon. That bill passed in 2007 unanimously in both chambers. It was a real consensus approach that owes a lot to the efforts of the manufacturers, the industry, to support. This bill in front of us, we'll hear more about, does a couple of things, but one is that it expands the number of the types of equipment that can be added to the program. So printers, mice, mouses, keyboards. The original program, the existing program, is just CPUs and monitors. So the other piece of this comes from the manufacturers, their desire to get credit in the program for recycling more than their obligations under the program we established. So really appreciate the efforts of the manufacturers to step up to the plate, both in 2007 and then again in this session, to make a electronics waste recycling program that works for Oregonians. And I'm sure we'll hear much more about it in our remaining 20 minutes today. But thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for getting us started. And we've got our two first testifiers, so please go right ahead.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. Thank you for letting me testify today on Senate Bill 82. I wanted to state for the record that the department supports this bill, and I apologize if I'm repeating some of what Co-Chair Cannon said, but the bill does not have a fiscal impact on DEQ in the 2011-2013 biennium. There is a revenue impact, expenditure impact on the department in 2013-2015 biennium. The key provisions of the bill are that keyboards and mice would be added to the Oregon eCycles program, but that doesn't happen until 2015. Printers would also be added to the eCycles program, and that would not happen until 2015. And then there is the provision in the bill for credits, and that's for the manufacturers who collect in excess of their minimum recycling obligations. They can use those credits to meet their recycling obligations in a year, current year, or in a future year, or sell those to another manufacturer program. And with that, I will stop and take any questions the committee may have.
Anybody have any questions? Go ahead, Jeff.
Madam Co-Vice Chair, and currently coming in, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames. I'm here on behalf of Dell Computer, which is just conveniently here, right here. And I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 82. Dell actually is the only manufacturer, I believe, that does their own statewide recycling program. We actually partnership around the nation with Goodwill Industries. Many of you may have probably seen those trucks, or I know I have, the Goodwill trucks where you bring in your computer, and Dell will pay for that recycling to happen. And we have, since the inception of the program, collected over our goal every single time. And we believe that this is a good provision that the Department of Environmental Quality brought forward through the work group that goes on in the interim. And we feel it's a good approach to allowing the flexibility for manufacturers by providing these credits in subsequent years to, if in the case where we see a big drop off in the poundage, or if the numbers don't match up with what the goal is, to provide some flexibility in subsequent years to be able to protect from that downside risk. So we actually are very supportive of the bill, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Great. Any questions? There are none. Thank you both. Holly Sears, Mike Dewey.
It's musical capital.
It is.
I would have moved this in the right place.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Holly Sears, and I'm the Governmental Affairs Director for the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. ORA members participate in the e-waste program. We're e-waste collectors. We have the we serve as collection sites for both the state contractor program and manufacturer programs. We support the addition of printers and peripherals into the e-waste program. Oftentimes, we have customers that bring printers and mice and keyboards to our facilities because they already assume that they're in the e-waste program, and we find ways to recycle them currently, but outside of the program. So we view printers and peripherals as just another way to, if you bring them into the program, is just another way to extend better service to our customers and divert more material from the waste stream. ORA does not support, however, the addition of printers and peripherals into the list of items that are banned from the landfill. When House Bill 2626, the original e-waste bill, was passed in 2007, the major consideration for imposing a landfill ban on TVs and computers was that there were hazardous substances in them, such as lead, mercury, and cadmium. And if the same standard were to hold true for Senate Bill 82, printers, mice, and keyboards would not be added to the list of banned items from landfills because they do not contain those same hazardous substances. So therefore, ORA respectfully requests that printers, mice, and keyboards not be subject to the ban until a clear and consistent standard is established for determining whether or not to impose a landfill ban. It is important to note that if electronics do end up in a landfill, they are safe there. Landfills operate pursuant to DEQ permits, and those permits establish very stringent environmental standards that are designed to protect human health and the environment. ORA members landfills use state-of-the-art liners, environmentally innovative leachate collection systems, and groundwater monitoring to ensure protection of the environment. During the interim, ORA looks forward to having a more robust discussion with the department regarding inspection and enforcement of e-waste collection sites, to assess whether to bring future legislation forward that requires e-waste collectors to register with the department. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Did Mike already testify?
Mm-mm. He's up.
No questions until Mike has had the last word. Mr. Dewey.
Thank you, Co-Chair Cannon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Vice Chairs. Mike Dewey for the record. Waste management, I started working on this legislation on behalf of waste management in 2005. As you know, we were able to pass a very, very good bill. It has been an industry leader. It has surprised us how well the bill has functioned. I give a lot of credit to DEQ for that. They worked very hard on this. It is complicated to understand all the formulas in terms of what is to be collected. Waste management operates six collection sites within the program, and we've enjoyed working with the high-tech community. So we support the new amendments in Senate Bill 82. I would agree with my colleague, Ms. Sears, in terms of the difference between the products that are the goods that are going to come into this program compared to what is in the program today in terms of toxicity. And at some point, and I'm not sure where that discussion ought to be, we operate state-of-the-art landfills. And she talked a bit about the regulatory environment and the collection of leachate and the regulations behind that. So we do think at some point there ought to be a standard developed to decide what is necessary with regard to a ban. I'll finish by saying in 2005, I recall a lobbyist for the high-tech industry arguing we didn't need an e-waste bill because if it goes in the landfill, it's taken care of. And I was kind of surprised by that testimony, but I agreed with it because that's what we're doing in our landfills. So I'm not sure where this discussion takes us, but I do think it's worth having at some point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dewey. Questions for these two? Seeing none, Mr. Co-Chair, any closing thought on this bill till we go to the next step?
I have lots of thoughts on the landfill ban piece in particular. I'm just looking for the provision in the bill. Is it the mere insertion of these peripherals as covered electronic devices that then triggers their inclusion in the landfill ban?
Co-Chair Cannon, that's correct.
And as I recall, and we had this discussion related to the CPUs and the monitors, and am I right in remembering that you opposed inclusion, a landfill ban on those products as well?
We did oppose it, but we in the beginning, but we were able to work with the department on language that we felt more comfortable with. And the reason, our original reason for opposing it then was that the standard was different. So now it's a knowingly standard, which we agree makes it a lot easier for us to, if we see the material and we can safely pull it out, our employees can safely pull it out, then we will do that. But we can't knowingly dispose of it. So if we see it, we do need to pull it out if it's safe for us to do so. And that same standard would apply here, but the whole reason for the landfill ban, my understanding back in 2007, was that these materials were toxic and needed to stay out of the landfill, and that standard doesn't hold true for these products. So we just want to make sure that there's a clear and consistent standard for why we're imposing landfill bans and what is that standard. Is it toxicity? Is it the sheer volume of this material? Is it the percentage of electronics that are sold? I mean, what is the standard for including these in the landfill ban? We just want to make that more clear, and it's not right now.
Are you proposing that we would develop a standard related to the landfill bans within this bill? I'm trying to get a sense of what you're looking for in terms of how we would move forward.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Cannon, that is one possibility to look at putting a standard in the bill. We are proposing at this time that if there's no standard, that we remove the standard right now. Based on House Bill 2626, is that the materials are toxic, but that is not the case for the materials that were being included in Senate Bill 82. So we're asking that if that is the standard, that those materials be removed from the landfill ban.
Just one last follow-up. Maybe a comment more than a question, but I'm not sure that toxicity standard that you're describing is in the bill. I recognize it was a big part of the conversation that we had in 2007 related to House Bill 2626, and certainly I think was a part of the rationale, but I don't think the entire part of the rationale related to the landfill ban. I think there was a sense that, well, as long as the state is making available this free recycling program, free to consumers recycling program, then we want to make sure that we're getting in a sense, a good return on investment, that we're not landfilling at a cost items that could otherwise be diverted for recycling purposes into a recycling program. So, yes, toxicity, but also let's just use whatever tools we can to try to divert as much material as is eligible from landfills into the recycling program. I think it was a little broader than just the toxicity piece. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that comment.
Well, colleagues, thank you for hanging in there today. That's going to conclude our time today. I'm going to close.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you all for being here. It is time to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 82A. And unless there's something else from the committee, I will adjourn the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water.